You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. My name is Chris Lopez, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Justin Cooper of the Pine Financial Group. So Justin is a hard money lender with Pine Financial, and I asked Justin to come in today so we can pick his brain about hard money, talk about some loan products they have, and talk about some deals around the Denver market. So Justin, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. I'm glad you could make it. So, you know, this is a very basic question. Why is it called hard money?
Yeah, so I always like to joke, we call it hard money because it's hard on your wallet. And so it kind of breaks the ice a little bit, yeah. Right? Because I think a lot of people have this preconceived notion that hard money is expensive. And when you compare it to conventional loans, yeah, it can be, right? Certainly the numbers, interest rates, and other things are higher than a conventional loan. So I like to just break the ice and get that out there a little bit. But you know, when we, and maybe we will dive deeper on this in the podcast, but really it's hard money is a means to an end, right? And it's used by real estate investors to get into deals faster than conventional loans, to buy properties that conventional loans won't qualify for. And a lot of it is more based on the asset than the investor. But really the term hard money comes from the fact that we're lending on a hard asset against real estate. So real estate is a hard asset. So hard money, that's where the hard comes from.
Oh, so it's actually talking about the asset rather than the source of the money.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. So, you know, when I first got in the real estate world, I heard about hard money and it took me a while to kind of understand what it is. So I know we got some listeners out there that were probably in my shoes a couple of years ago. So just give everyone out there the difference between a normal, you know, conventional loan that they get on their home versus what hard money is. Like you touched on, but let's kind of give some, you know, differences between the two.
Yeah. So first off, most people get a conventional loan, get a regular mortgage when they're buying their primary residence, when they're buying their home. And so what we're talking about today as a hard money lender and talking about on the investment podcast here is buying an investment property. So first off, that's a pretty big divider. Most hard money lenders will not lend on anything owner occupied. They're making business purpose loans, commercial loans for business purposes. So they're lending on investment properties, not anything owner occupied. So that's maybe the first thing. Another big thing is the term, how long of a loan it is. And when we're talking conventional loans, we're generally talking 30-year loans, right? We're talking years, maybe a 15-year, something like that. But in the hard money world, we're talking in months. If you get a 12-month, a one-year term, then that's a pretty long hard money loan. So most loans are made in months. So that's probably the second big thing. And then the third is something that we had talked about, is the cost. So in the hard money world, we talk about two main numbers, points and interest. And in the conventional world, we're really only talking about one, the interest rate. And so right now in today's world, interest rates are pretty low, still historically low.
Yeah.
You know, 4-5% interest rates. In the hard money world, we're talking double digits, 10, 12, 15, 18% interest. But along those lines, and now obviously that number sounds dramatically higher, much scarier, but we're also calculating that interest differently. In a conventional world, we're amortizing over 30 years. Whereas so what we're talking about there means your conventional loan payment will cover some of the principal balance and interest. Whereas in the hard money world, we're talking interest only loans. So it's a much easier way to calculate it. If you're paying 15% interest, then you just take whatever your loan amount is times 0.15 for 15%. And then that'll give you your yearly total interest. And then you would divide by 12 for 12 months to figure out your payments. So the interest is calculated differently and the numbers are different. Those are probably some of the major ways that the two are different.
And something else too is, I mean, if I go get a loan, a conventional lender, they're looking more at my credit history, my income, my debt to ratio. For hard money lenders, you're more focused on, hey, what is the asset you're buying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the conventional world, they're concerned about getting paid back over 30 years. So they're really underwriting the borrower, the client, the person buying the house. Whereas in the hard money world, we're more concerned with the asset. Are you getting into a good deal? Are you going to be profitable on it? You know, if you're doing repairs, which most hard money lenders will lend repair money or lend on properties that need repair. So are you doing the appropriate repairs? If you're going to sell it as a fix and flip, what value what's the sale price? We call it the ARV or after repair value. What can you sell this thing for? And what you think you can sell it for and what we may think you can sell it for. Are they the same? And then, of course, will there be profit? So we're looking much more at the deal itself than the borrower. Now, most hard money lenders are also looking at the borrower, but we're looking at it from a very different angle than the conventional world. The conventional world is looking to make sure that come hell or high water, you'll be able to make that monthly payment. The hard money lenders generally want to make sure we're not going to set our clients up to fail. We want to make sure that when there's a change order, if your contractor skips town, something like that happens, do you have the money to keep the project moving forward, to pay that electrician to stay on site, to hire a new contractor, whatever that may be, and keep the project going?
And that's your the individual's reserve money in their savings account or checking account versus a line of credit or an improvement escrow with you guys, right?
Correct. Okay. Correct. So each hard money lender can do things differently. So at Pine Financial Group, we can cover the repair money, potentially 100% of the repairs. But once there's a change order, that's not in that amount that we have escrowed and ready for you.
And what is a change order?
A change order, let's say you're going to be doing some electrical work in the house. And so you're going to be changing the outlets and the covers and the switches and just the real cosmetic stuff that you can see. And that's, let's say, $500 line item on your budget. And then you buy the property. And on day two, your electrician gets in there, starts doing the work, and realizes that you actually have to rewire the whole house. And so now instead of $500, it's going to cost you $5,000. So that $4,500 change order, right, going from the switches in the outlets to rewiring the whole house, that is unexpected. And because it's a change to the original, you know, scope of work, that's where that comes from. And so what I was referring to is, you know, we have $500 set aside for that electrical work, but now you need $5,000. So where does that extra money come from? That's one of the things that we're going to want to make sure that you have some money in case those things happen.
And so what are the loan products that you and Pine Financial have to offer? Like, you know, people are familiar with conventional loans where, hey, it's usually a 30 or 15 year is, you know, kind of the basis, but Pine Financial and hard money lenders in general have usually a different suite of loan products. Just what are the ones that you guys have?
Yeah, so Pine Financial has two main loans these days. We've got our rehab loan, which, as the name kind of implies, we can lend the rehab money. And so this is the loan we've been doing for over 10 years now. We've closed well over 1,300 of them. And what we do is we want to cover 100% of your costs. So 100% of the purchase price, no down payment on your purchase price. We want to cover 100% of the repairs and 100% of the closing costs. So literally at closing, this could be one of those real no money down deals, not necessarily the late night infomercial type stuff, but where your lender will cover your purchase and your repairs and your closing costs.
So the investor has to bring zero to the table, essentially.
Yeah, if it's a good enough deal. And then, so now you know how much you can borrow from us, but how do I know that I can lend it to you? With that loan, we lend it based on the after repair value, that ARV again. And what we'll do is we'll lend up to 70% of the after repair value. So that kind of holds in line with the old investor rule of the 70% rule.
Where you explain that rule.
Yeah, so the 70% rule basically says you want your purchase and repairs to be equal to or less than 70% of the after repair value. And the reason is not necessarily the 70%, but it's the 30%, the other side of that. So if your costs are on the 70% side, what's on the 30% side? Well, first off, it's your profit. And that's the biggest thing that we're worried about. But there are other things. It's not all 30% is your profit. You've got the cost to sell. This is something so many investors skip over and forget about. It takes money to sell a property. The biggest one, of course, is real estate agents. But you might have some concessions. Of course, we're going to go to a title company and sign a bunch of paperwork there, and that costs money. So we have the cost to sell, and then we also have holding costs. So if you're getting a hard money loan, you're going to have monthly interest payments. Even if you're borrowing private money, even if you have a partner, somewhere or another, there might be some holding costs. Even if it's just the water bill and the electric bill and the heating bill and those types of things, there's holding costs. And so those types of things come from that 30%. And then also your profit. And so we want to keep our costs on the acquisition side, the purchase and repairs, and hopefully even those closing costs when you're buying, at or near that 70%. Because when you're selling, that cost to sell, real estate agents are still going to charge the same amount. So is the title company, right? So those costs are basically fixed. So the higher your acquisition costs, the purchase and repairs, the less profit there will be. So that's why we want to keep to that 70% purchase and repairs of 70%, because that will maximize the profit on the back end of the deal.
And does that 70% rule, I mean, does that generally hold true whether it's an asset that's $200,000 versus $800,000? I mean, or does it change as, the more expensive properties?
Well, I think that's kind of a loaded question there, Chris. So what we're talking about with the percentages is just that. It's a percentage. But when we convert it into actual dollars, that's when things might, people may sharpen their pencil. Because whatever, let's say it be, you're figuring your profit will be 15% because you've got the cost to sell and holding costs and other things. So if we're assuming 15% of that, just for round numbers, would be your profit, 15% of a $200,000 ARV sale price is going to be very different in dollars than a $500,000 ARV. And so when we're up into that $500,000, maybe the dollars are okay if our profit is only 10%. So it kind of depends. And it goes back to every individual investor has individual goals and requirements. And so we use these rules and guidelines to point us in the right direction, but everybody has to come up with what's best for them. If you want to make more money, then maybe you're not trying to do the 70% rule. Maybe you're working on a 65% rule. Your purchase and repairs at 65% of the ARV because you want more profit. Or maybe because you're playing the much higher price points, maybe you're okay doing 75% because the profit dollars are significant enough to still make it worth the risk of doing it.
So the 70% is really just a rule of thumb, and it comes down to the deal and the individual ultimately for every deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
So your first loan product's the rehab loan. What's the second most popular loan product that you guys have?
Yeah, so our second loan is our acquisition loan. And this one's really been taken off and been really popular this year. And what we do on the acquisition loan is we will lend up to 90% of the purchase price. And that's it. So we're not going to lend any repair money. We're not going to cover the closing costs. And you'll have 10% down. But with this, the costs are a little bit less. So our points are lower. Our interest rate is lower. It's still, for us, both of these loans are 9 months long with no prepayment penalties. And what I mean by no prepayment penalty is if you pay us off in under 9 months, say you get your fix and flip done in 6 months or 4 months, there's no extra fees or penalties. There's no minimum interest due or anything like that. But the acquisition loan, one of the things that separates this from the rehab loan is we do not need an appraisal. With the rehab loan, we're going to order an appraisal to confirm your after repair value. Usually only takes about a week for us to get that, but that's still a week. We have to go through in our diligence before we can close. And in the acquisition loan, we do not need an appraisal, so we can move faster. We're saving at least that 1 week. So closing time can be much faster.
And I'm assuming that's just because with the acquisition loan, I'm putting 10% down, therefore I got skin in the game, and therefore there's some extra margin from your guys' perspective as well?
Yeah, as a lender, we're always concerned with, our risk. Of course, we're looking out for our clients as well, but we are, of course, concerned with our risk and the risk to our investors, where our money comes from. And so, yeah, having 10% down and a lower loan amount feels less risky, and so we're able to get comfortable with those deals, mainly through just some comps that we're able to pull and that our investors pull for the acquisition loan.
And so what are the points and interest rates for both those loan products?
Yeah, so the rehab loan, we charge 3 points and 12.9% interest. And so 1 point is 1% of the loan amount. It's what we charge in origination to make the loan. And the points come upfront at closing when you're buying. So on the rehab loan, it's part of those closing costs we might be able to roll into the loan. And then on the acquisition loan, we charge 2 points and 12% interest. So a little bit lower points, a little bit lower interest. And of course, that's going to be on a lower loan amount. So the dollars will be less.
Okay. So, I know it's easy as you listen to podcasts or people out there on Google or BiggerPockets, just whether it's a conventional lender or hard money lender. Hey, what's your rates? What's your rates? What's your rates? What's your rates? And just go across the board. I mean, is it as simple as go with the cheapest rates, which, you know, usually in business, when I've gone with the cheapest person, it's not always the best decision. So I'm assuming it's not. But I'd love to get your take, because I know there's a bunch of hard money lenders out there. Everyone has different terms and everything like that. Like, how can someone out there that's wanting to get into fix and flips or start using hard money evaluate hard money loans besides just saying, okay, rates between different people?
That's a great question, Chris. And so I've actually been working on a list of questions to be asking a hard money lender. I think it'll be a really good article, you know, for Pine Financial, for the podcast, and Denver Investment Real Estate website as well. May even turn it into a class. And of course, the cost is something that's on there. It's one of the questions, but I actually have it as one of the last questions because I think there's so many other factors that go into choosing the right hard money lender. So first and foremost, you know, how long have they been around? Are they brand new? Have they been around like for 10 years like Pine Financial has? What kind of track record do they have? You know, understanding their loans and understanding and converting that into what are you, the investor, needing, right? Do you need that 100% loan? Or do you have enough cash to cover the repairs yourself? And then the acquisition loan might be a good fit. Or is there a loan that's kind of a hybrid between the two that is something you're more interested in? So understanding your needs first and foremost, and then comparing that to what the hard money lender can offer is going to be really important. Understanding the term. If you're doing projects where the construction may be $200,000, maybe a 6-month loan is not long enough and you need a lender who offers longer term. So you have to understand that. Maybe you're just doing the opposite and you're doing quick $20,000 cosmetic rehabs on condos and you're in and out and the construction is done in weeks, not even months. And so does the lender have any prepayment penalties? So that's important to understand. All these other nuances that we've kind of been talking about already, specifically about Pine Financial, all of these are what I like to refer to as the apples and the oranges, right? Because you have to compare every one of these little points to find out what's going to be best for you. You know, we talked a little bit about conventional loans. Most conventional lenders are doing the exact same thing. There's not a whole lot of difference between them. But when it comes to the hard money world, it seems like every lender is doing things differently to try and differentiate themselves. So you really have to get into the nuances of their loan. But also, as you're doing this, you're trying to find out and get comfortable with the lender themselves. Do you click with them? Do you resonate with them? Are you guys building rapport? Are they offering advice along the way? A lot of hard money lenders are just experienced investors who've made some money and now want to have slightly more passive investments where they're not managing the tenants or swinging the hammer for the fix and flips. So there could be a lot of experience in the investing world that you can capitalize on. You know, one of the unmentioned benefits of hard money is generally you're working with somebody that's really experienced. Or are they not? Do they just come from maybe the banking world and they want to, you know, dip their toe into the real estate lending world? And thus, when you're asking them, hey, should I open up this wall or what should I do over here? They may not know. They may understand financing really well, but not real estate investing. So understanding who that lender is and do you connect with them, I think is one of the most important ones, because you're not just going to get their money and disappear for months. You'll probably be talking to them somewhat frequently, whether it be through a draw process or just picking their brain and asking for advice or whatever it may be. You want to make sure you get along with your hard money lender.
Yeah, I mean, because you know, that's something I've learned. And the one fix and flip I did is, you know, with a conventional loan, I've got my primary residence. Man, once closing day happens, you're done with the conventional lender, and just you just have to make your payments to whoever they tell you to send the checks off to. Where once you get the hard money loan for a fix and flip, a lot of work to do, lots of communication, and it's really just getting started until that project is completed. And I think something else that took me a while to understand this and appreciate my own learning curve in real estate is that working with people that have done a lot of deals have a different perspective. You have your finger on the pulse of the market as to, hey, what's working well, what's not, you know, recommendations, trends going on, and stuff that you can't find on anywhere other than by, you know, doing it 40, 50, 60 hours a week, week in, week out, and then you know that stuff. So if someone wants to come out and, you know, get into fix and flips, do they find a deal first? Do they talk to hard money lenders first? What advice could you give someone that wants to get into this world?
That's a great question. There is no one right answer. as a lender, I always prefer to get my clients pre-approved. So come to me before you have a deal so that we can talk about what does a loan look like and what are the requirements, not just in the deal, but also of you, the borrower, so that when you do go out and find a deal, that you're finding the right type of deal, the right size of deal. If you are a new investor and you only have a very limited amount of reserves, you know, cash in the bank, it may make a lot more sense, or you may have to tackle one of those smaller projects, maybe to stay in that first time home buyer price point. Whereas if you're sitting on a bunch of cash, or you have a partner who has a significant amount of liquidity, maybe you can just dive right into the higher price points. So understanding that before you dive in can be important, because you don't want to waste your time. You don't want to waste your agent's time. You don't want to go around running around town looking at a bunch of wholesale deals that ultimately you wouldn't even qualify for. So I think having a good understanding of how much you're pre-approved for and what the loan will look like, then you can go out and properly identify the types of properties, the types of deals, and be able to analyze them. Last thing you want to do is analyze a deal your way and then go to your hard money lender and realize they analyze it completely differently and you guys are worlds apart and you have earnest money at risk. So take a few minutes. I mean, I talk to people all the time, and in somewhere between 5 and 20 minutes, we can get them pre-approved. We can go through the loan scenario, make sure everybody's on the same page with how we're analyzing the deal, and now they're off to the races. So it really doesn't take a whole lot of time to go through the effort of getting pre-approved.
So if I call you up and say, hey, Justin, I want to get pre-approved. I mean, do I need to have 3 years tax returns? Are you pulling my credit? What exactly, what documentation do you need? And do you have to pull my credit?
Well, I hope you have a lot more than just 3 years of tax returns. Not that I need to seal them. I just hope you've been filing your taxes appropriately. So for us on the pre-approval side, I just want to get to know you through an application. So I don't actually need to verify anything up front. It's more in the conversation and just understanding how liquid you are, you know, and I'm trusting you, right? Obviously, if you lie on the application, then the truth will come out when you're under contract. And then again, your earnest money is at risk. So just filling out the application for us, which takes 5 to 10 minutes, is quick and easy to email back and forth. We're incredibly responsive. So you could have that pre-approval today. If we chatted on the phone this morning, I sent you the application, you fill it out, send it back, I could have that pre-approval letter in your hand today even.
What's the basics, the main questions on the pre-approval application? Just net worth, or like list your bank accounts, how much cash you have, debts, like what's on there?
So the biggest one I'm concerned with is how liquid you are. How much do you have in checking and savings? Because ultimately, the biggest risk in the short term of a fix and flip are those change orders and a contractor walking out on you and those types of things. The moving parts, once you get the loan, the living, breathing fix and flip and all those things that could happen. And ultimately, anything that could trip you up will cost money, or money can solve a lot of those issues. So you want to make sure you have some money in the bank. And so what we're looking for at Pine Financial, I want to make sure you have at least $10,000 or 7.5% of the loan amount, whichever is higher. And of course, if we're just trying to get pre-approved, then we don't know what 7.5% of the loan amount is, because we don't know the loan amount, because we don't know the property yet. So, but just knowing how liquid you are, then we can say, okay, well, you've got more than 10,000, but let's dive into maybe some quick scenarios and say you've got 20,000. Okay, well, what does that look like? What does a no money down deal price point wise look like? What does a some money down deal look like price wise and stuff? And we can run through some really quick scenarios just to give you some guidance. So again, you know, tomorrow when you go out and try and find a deal, you know, one, how to be analyzing them, and two, what price points you should be playing in.
So for that liquidity metric, is it just savings and checkings, or does like IRAs and 401ks count in there as well?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so something that we differentiate from the conventional world in. Conventional lenders will look at your retirement accounts. Us at Pine Financial, we will not. Because again, we want to make sure that money is there to keep that contractor on site, right? When your electrician says, hey, it's not 500, it's 5,000. I need a check, or I got to go hit these other jobs, right? You don't have time to go and move money around and sell some stocks and then wait for Fidelity to cut you the check, right? You don't have that 3 days, 5 days, 2 weeks before you get that money, because yeah, the electrician will come back, but it took you 2 weeks to get the money. Then you call up the electrician and the electrician is like, great, I'll be over as soon as I can. Well, when is that? Well, I'm booked out for the next 2 weeks and I'll be there after that. So you just lost a month, right? And time is money. both because the market is always changing, sometimes up, sometimes down, but also there's hard money payments, right, that are creeping up on you, as well as everybody else getting delayed and getting pushed back, and how fast can they get back out on site? So we want to make sure you have money in the bank. You can literally cut the check right then and there, keep them on site, and keep them working.
Okay, that makes sense. So what are common mistakes that you see every investor, maybe newer investor, or just common mistakes you see that can maybe help some people avoid some pitfalls?
So one of the first things is in analyzing the deal. Too often, people forget all the different moving parts when they're analyzing a deal. First off, some people may just look at the purchase price versus the ARV and say, look at this great deal. Look at all the money that can be made. Well, you're automatically forgetting about the repairs, right? So understanding how much those repairs are, understanding all the moving parts. Like we had mentioned, there's closing costs when you're buying, closing costs when you're selling, there's holding costs, lots of different moving parts. So properly accounting for all those numbers when you're figuring out what your actual profit is going to be is probably one of the first things. One of the next ones is where are you getting the numbers to analyze, specifically the after repair value? There's a lot of nuances that go into that. There's both a science and an art, I think, in coming up with the after repair value. So understanding a little bit of the science and a little bit of the art, and then working with people that will help you who also understands those things. Of course, we can always get an appraisal, but that costs money and takes time. So maybe the quickest route, especially if you're new, is working with some good real estate agents. And they may say they can get you a CMA, but you don't want one of those 40-page CMAs that pulls every single property that's done anything in the past 18 months. You really just need the top 3 to 5 comparable properties. So what makes it comparable? We're looking at square footage, bedrooms, bathrooms, the style of home, the age of the home, the location, and then, of course, the quality. If you're going to be selling a beautiful fix and flip property, you want your comparables to be the beautiful fix and flip quality as well. So those are probably some of the biggest ones. One we see and hear quite often is people want to do the work themselves. They think they're going to save money by swinging the hammer themselves. And so at a certain level, you will, because you're not going to pay a contractor $25,000 to do the whole project. You yourself are going to have your cost, and maybe that's $20,000. So you're saving $5,000 where you think you are. But the difference, or one of the differences, is the contractor has a team of people, and they can have multiple trades in the house at the same time doing different projects. You are one person who can do one thing at a time. So the timeline might be different. So we're talking a contractor may be able to get your flip done in 3 weeks, but you doing it yourself may take 2 months, right? So that costs you some hard money payments. Sometimes these contractors may get good deals. They may have relationships with different wholesale outfits to be buying the plumbing supplies and the electrical supplies, where you may not, and you're just going to Home Depot paying off the shelf. And you may not be saving as much money on the materials. So there's a couple different things there that I see people think they're saving money on, but ultimately at the end of the project, maybe they didn't really save a whole bunch of money on.
I mean, what always comes to my mind when I think about doing something myself, because I worked for a general contract for a few years between like high school and summer semesters. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I was the cheap labor to crawl in the crawl spaces and pull out insulation or move a pile of dirt from one corner to the other corner of the lot. That's a lot of what I did. But I learned a lot, so I know how to swing a hammer. I'm around there. But, I mean, I've done quite a few projects around houses and condos I've lived in. And, man, every time you rip down a piece of drywall, everything is different between one house and another. One's a 1940s house with, oh my gosh, I've never seen anything like that before. And then there's something else. Oh, is that asbestos? I have no idea. And then it's me spending a lot of time on YouTube, which is not a good use of my time. And I found that I often do, it takes me a lot longer to do like half the quality work as someone that does it day in, day out. So I've learned that lesson, and I agree with you there, Justin, that it's really hard to evaluate. And my wife is always happy to point out that whenever I estimate a project around the house, it takes at least twice as long and twice as much money. And I unfortunately have to agree with her most of the time, but that's how it is. And I'm not the only person like that.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to look at the time value of money for that, right? If you could hire, say, a handyman or a contractor to do something for $12, $15, $30 an hour, right? But you're doing that work instead, you're basically saying your time as an investor is only worth that $10, $12, $30 an hour. So really, as an investor, I think the highest and best use of our time is finding good deals and then managing the process and making sure it goes quickly and smoothly. And that can ultimately relate to a much, much higher dollar per hour.
So I want to start pivot to some other questions here, Justin. I'm looking at my list of questions, and I realized in the beginning I forgot to give people background on you and introduce to you. And that's just partly because I talk with Justin all the time. We're friends, or you know, we call, we email back and forth. He's been on quite a few podcast webinars in the past. So I apologize for people out there that have not heard Justin before. But I mean, you've been in hard money lending for about 7 years. He's an active investor on Denver. He's done fix and flips. He owns rental properties. Fill in a gap for 30 seconds, Justin, about you know what your investing background experience is, because I think that's really impressive when you talk with someone because you're in the market as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually started investing back in 2007. That was when I bought my first property, which for some people was an amazing time to be an investor. But for me, being a new investor, it was a horrible time because a lot of these mistakes that I talk about, I've done them myself. Thankfully, I've learned over the past decade. But yeah, that first deal, it did not go well. I tried doing the work myself and realized, just like you said, Chris, things take three times, five times as long, at least for me. And the cost, you know, even just on materials was through the roof. Ultimately, I did hire someone and it was amazing how much work got done once I put actual contractors into the house. But it was a tough time. You know, the market was moving and not the way that it is in today's market. So I wound up losing money on that first project. But hindsight being what it is, and me just really falling in love with real estate. I thought I would love it, and then I did the project, and I knew for sure that this was what I really wanted to do. So even though I lost money, I wasn't completely turned off by it, but I was very scared. I did not want to lose money. I could not lose money again. So it slowed me down a little bit, but I've been able to go back and look and see what did I screw up and what could I have done better. And I try and share that with my clients all day, every day. I mean, I look at myself as a consultant helping people out to not make those mistakes, right? You can learn by doing it yourself and do it one way, or you can learn from others' mistakes, right? And learn off their experience.
Absolutely.
Which again is one of those huge benefits of working with hard money lenders typically is because they have that experience. But yeah, so since that time, that first deal, I went on and I tried my hand at wholesaling deals and I did a lot of off-market marketing. I got some pretty bad looks from my wife at the rehearsal dinner when I was taking phone calls from sellers and when I was sending off contracts literally before our flight, sitting at DIA on our way to the honeymoon. I've done successful fix and flips. I've built new construction. I have bought performing notes and non-performing notes. I've used my self-directed IRA to invest. I've tried my hand at a lot of different things. Maybe not an expert at some of those things, but I've definitely gotten my hands dirty and made money at them. So I've only lost money on that first deal. But over the past decade, I've done a lot of different types of investing and just love playing in real estate all day, every day.
And that's exactly why I asked Justin to come on, because he's got an impressive background. So a couple questions that I'm sure you get all the time, because I get all the time. How do people find deals for fix and flips, Justin?
That is such a good question.
I'm sure it's the first one you've gotten in this entire month that someone asking that question, right?
So, you know, there's the old standbys, which still work. Have a good real estate agent. 90, 95, 99% of the market is on the MLS. And the way you have access to the MLS is through real estate agents. So work with a good real estate agent. Now, that could take different forms, right? You could work with a new agent and kind of help groom them if you know how they should be groomed, or work with the more experienced ones who work with other investors and they know how to find a good deal. But no matter what, be working with at least one real estate agent. Some investors, depending on the scope and scale of their business, will have several real estate agents they work with. You know, maybe they designate different agents for different parts of town, different farm areas. I would get on every single wholesaler's list that's out there. A wholesaler is basically an acquisition specialist. Their job is to go out, find good deals, and then turn them over to investors. They don't do fix and flips. They don't do the tenants and toilets and landlord stuff. All they do is find good deals. So I would get on every one of their lists, but know that they're not finding deals just for you. They have other buyers. And so if you get on their list and they start emailing you properties that don't seem to fit your criteria, that's because there's somebody on their list whose criteria it does fit. Maybe you're trying to do fix and flips, and maybe the next three deals a wholesaler finds are more geared towards landlords. Okay, so just understand that, take a quick look, and move on. But stay on their list, don't get frustrated, and maybe the right deal will hit. But get to know all of them, because all of these wholesalers are out there looking in different markets for different types of deals, run their numbers differently, so get to know all of them. If you have the time and money and knowledge and skills, I would be doing the off-market stuff, things that some really good real estate agents do, things that a lot of wholesalers do. If you can do it yourself, I would try that as well. And what I mean by that would be sending letters, sending postcards, doing direct mail. It means knocking on doors. It means putting little post-it notes on people's cars. It means putting bandit signs out, but not just doing that outbound stuff. You then have to be prepared for when the phone rings, right? You're trying to get people to pick up the phone and call you and say, hey, I have a distressed property or I'm in a distressed situation. Please buy my house. So the only way that that works is by actually picking up the phone. I can't tell you how many bandit signs I call and nobody answers or nobody calls me back.
It
blows my mind. People spent time and money buying these things, putting them together, putting them out there.
Putting them out, I've done those. It's a pain in the butt.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't get a call back. So it's interesting. But be prepared for that. Answer the phone. And now, of course, this is where the extra skills and effort come in, because you have to be ready to answer the phone. And then you have to know what to say when they answer the phone. You need to have some sort of script, and you have to know what the objective is when they call. Are you trying to get an appointment? Are you trying to get a contract right then and there on the phone? Right? What are those next steps? You're going to be meeting the actual seller at their house, most likely, to be negotiating. So can you build rapport? Can you get to know these people? Can you think on the fly and analyze the deal and come up with what your purchase price is? Can you properly convey that to them? And really, most importantly, when you're talking to these distressed sellers, you're trying to solve their problem, right? They have an issue. And one of the ways that you might be able to help them is by buying their house. So can you properly convey that and help them understand what their situation is and how selling their house to you might actually help them? So if you can do those types of things, that's probably the three biggest ways I would say. Work with good agents, buy from wholesalers, or at least get to know the wholesalers and look at their deals, and then do the off-market stuff and go direct to the sellers.
And I would just want to give people some of my experiences, because, you know, they're all three great ways. They're different. And, you know, real estate agent and wholesaler, they're making their money because they're finding the deals and they're getting their commission or assignment fee. Where if you're doing the direct mail, the bandit side, on advertising, you're basically kind of taking one of their roles and you're finding yourself. And I've done all those things Justin has said, some for real estate, all those for other businesses in the past. And I've coached people, I've consulted people, I've done it for other people in the past, well, myself. And I can tell you, that's not something you say, oh, I'm going to try this for a weekend. I'm going to spend a week at putting out signs or that. It is essentially, I've always told people in the past, it is a new business you're learning. It's going to take a commitment of time. It's going to take a commitment of money. Because you don't have to go out there and throw out 30 bandit sides one weekend and get a deal the next week. Now, you might be that, you know, that one lucky person out of, like, you know, one in a million that, yes, there's always that one statistic. But generally speaking, that's not going to happen. And then you have to deal with, hey, someone calls you, you pick up the phone, and then, man, knowing how to handle those questions, talk to people, get over there and talk to them. It's a whole nother skill set. So, and look, I love that stuff. Like, that's the stuff I enjoy, that type of market. That's my background. But I just want to give you that perspective that it is essentially a new skill set and almost a new business that you're learning, in addition to learning how to fix and flip a property. But if you can learn that, you can make a tremendous amount of money that way as well. So Justin, I want to pick your brain, since you're in a really cool position of getting to work with lots of investors. I know you work with Kevin and Travis in the Pine Office, lots of other, like, you know, successful people in the industry. Like, you've got a really good position on, like, what's going on in the market. So, you know, we're in what, late summer, early fall of 2018. Like, what's the current landscape out there for fix and flip, fix and holds, or that short-term money? Like, what's the market doing? Where should people focus their efforts on? Type of deals looking for, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like it's going to be more of the same. We've had a market that has been appreciating very well over the past several years. And although a lot of people are expecting the doom and the gloom and are expecting another crash like 07, 08, 09, first off, I think that was a once in a generation thing. That, now, I mean, I'm not an economist and have no background in any of this, but that seems like the last time anything of that scale happened was the Great Depression, right? So it's like a once in a generation thing. So I'm not scared of having a repeat of that, but I am conscious of market cycles, right? It does go up and down. We have some little blips. We had something, you know, at 2000, 2001, we had something in the 80s here in Denver. So those are the things I'm more conscious about, and what will that look like and how will that affect my business? And more importantly, how can I be, you know, buying and setting myself up for when those, you know, little corrections along the way happen. So that's really what I'm worried about. And so I was at an event just this past weekend, and I was chatting with a lot of investors, both new and some that I've known for years. And everybody kind of kept saying that, you know, hey, the market is changing and it's slowing down and things are getting tight and properties are sitting, and which is true. It is. And that happens every single year. And I could be wrong about this, but I have a feeling that it's really just the yearly cycle, right? We're coming into fall. The fun, exciting summer is over. Kids are back in school. And so buyers are slowing down a little bit. It feels like the hot season has actually shifted. Everybody thinks, you know, late spring and summer is the hot time. But it seems like over the past year or two, it's been closer to February, March has been hotter, which means we're on 180 degrees from that time of year. This might be the slower time. And so I'm thinking that's really what's going on in the market, and it's just going to be seasonal. I'll be proved right or wrong probably in February, March of 2019 if it picks up again. If not, then all right, I was wrong. I'll admit it. But that's what I'm thinking. I think things are just slowing down. Buyers, everybody's settling in. The summer's over. School's in session. Buyers are slowing down. We still have basically record low inventory, but something I've found pretty interesting. When we look at inventory levels, we're saying it should be an extremely strong seller's market, right? There's not many sellers, but there's a lot of buyers out there. So the sellers should hold the cards and be able to negotiate, you know, strongly in their favor. But what we're seeing is a lot of buyers out there are saying, okay, you did a fix and flip, but show me your work. Show me receipts. Show me before and after pictures. Show me permits. Show me that what you did to this house is done correctly. And that's something I think we typically see more in a balanced market or in a buyer's market, where the buyers are requesting lots of stuff. But we're seeing that today. So buyers are still being savvy.
So I want to interrupt. So you're saying you're seeing that's been going on the last few years, or that's a more recent trend that you and your clients are seeing?
Well, we're definitely seeing it today.
Okay.
I think that it's been going on for maybe a year or two, you know, that I have recognized. But, you know, when you look at by the book, what is a seller's market? What does a seller's market mean? You don't really hear things like that, but we're certainly seeing it. So that's something to be aware of. Just because, you know, you're hearing inventory is super low, it's a seller's market, I can do whatever I want as a fix and flipper, that's not necessarily true. You know, you should do everything above board. You should be getting the permits. You should be showing your work and be proud of it. Put out a quality product and stand behind it, because buyers are looking for that. They want you to stand behind your work.
So Justin, I'm looking at my notes here. Another question I have for you here is just about contractors. I mean, you know, that is such an important piece in doing a fix and flip. I mean, what advice can you give? I know it's a really tough question, a very loaded question, but what advice can you give for people finding a contractor, vetting a contractor, and, you know, getting at least not, you know, ripped off or anything?
So we get this question all the time, you know, what contractor can you recommend? Can you send me some referrals? And kind of as a rule, Pine Financial doesn't recommend any contractors. And I think any seasoned investor will kind of nod their head. You know, they get it without even having to explain it. And the reason for that is, and I'm sure there's contractors listening, and if you are, you're probably the exception to this, but contractors seem to be kind of a fickle bunch. And I don't necessarily know why. Maybe I can make some guesses. But what I mean by that is they may be great for one deal, two deals, for five deals. They may be great for 2 years, but eventually something's going to happen, whether they just fall off the wagon, they get distracted with something else, or they just start getting greedy thinking, you know, they're going to get all your work. And so their prices start going up. Something is going to change. And so we don't know when that's going to happen or what that'll look like. So what I always recommend is to always have a stable of contractors. First off, just to keep an honest man honest, you want to be getting a couple bids for each deal, just to make sure that, you know, even your top contractor, their pricing is staying fair, right? You want to get a couple bids on that. But also, you just don't know when somebody's going to fall out, or maybe when somebody's subcontractor is going to fall out. And you got to make sure that you know some folks to have them jump right in, because time is money on fix and flips. So when they're asking, well, how do I find these people? What I would say is, what neighborhoods are you looking to invest in? And as you're driving around looking for deals, right? Maybe you're driving for dollars, be driving for contractors. Find those dumpsters in the yard. Look at the properties that look like they're under construction. They don't have to be fix and flips. They could be owner occupied, but you're finding contractors who are in your neighborhood. So they understand the price points. They understand the finishes. They understand the quality. And so you want to be knocking on those doors, walk into those properties and get to know who they are, get their contact info and follow up with them. And so I would always be doing that because you never know when you're going to need that next contractor. So always have a stable of contractors ready to go.
And I mean, I find what you say, and I mean, that's how most of colleagues I know in real estate, they usually won't recommend or refer out contractors because it only takes that one bad contracting experience. And then your reputation by referral is now down the drain. And you come back and say, hey, dude, you recommended person A to B. He ripped me off. What's going on? You're like, dude, that's not my fault. But now your reputation is dragged through the mud. So it's not that Justin and other people, because his is the more common answer you'll get from people. It's not that they're trying to avoid you or not give you answers. It's because, you know, what he gave you is a reality and a very frank answer to what goes on the market and what goes on that segment. So yeah, thank you, Justin.
Yeah, I actually had that happen. I had gotten a referral for a contractor on one of my projects. And in the middle of it, things started going south. And I understand I may not be the easiest one to work for, but it definitely wasn't going as smooth as we thought it would at the beginning and the way my investor friend had made it sound. And so I called up my investor friend and I said, hey, have you been like, this is what's going on. Is it me or is it not me? And unfortunately she said, nope, I've been running into the same thing. They're on four of my projects and I'm running into the same thing. So this other investor who had a ton of great experience was comfortable making the referral. All of a sudden, this contractor starts going down the tubes, both for me and for her.
So at least you guys were in the canoe up the creek without a paddle together, right?
Exactly.
You could at least get over a beer and complain to each other. So Justin, to wrap things up here, you and Pine Financial, you guys have a lot of great free content on your website. You do webinars, you teach classes, you put on events. How can people, first off, get plugged into some of the great resources that you guys have out there? Where do they go?
So several places. Probably the easiest is to go to our website, pinefinancialgroup.com. If you're looking for something coming up immediately and see what's on their calendar right now, go to the events page at pinefinancialgroup.com. We list everything we're doing right there. It should be a pretty easy way to sign up for our newsletter and our email list. And so we stay in touch with all of our clients. That way, we email out any upcoming events and things that we're doing that way. We also have several meetup groups. We've got 6 or 7 different meetup groups. So if you're on meetup.com, if you're familiar, go there and check out, look for Pine Financial. The groups are not necessarily named Pine Financial, but if you're just looking to get into some great groups anyway, go to meetup.com. We're there as well as a lot of other great groups, meetup.com. That's probably the highlights. Go get on our email list, go to our website and follow us on Meetup as well as the social medias.
And you guys also I know you do webinars. It's a monthly webinar you do, right?
Yeah, we do a monthly webinar. So what we used to do was a monthly in-person networking group. We did one in Fort Collins. We did one in Colorado Springs. We did one in Denver. And then as our business grew and we continued to expand into other markets, it was difficult to keep up with some really great content in all the different markets. So what we try to do is consolidate a little bit, still provide a ton of great value, but we do it through a webinar. So now you can get this great content, you know, in the comfort of your home. You don't have to be driving across town at rush hour to make it to the event.
And if people want to reach out to you directly, Justin, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Probably my email. So justin@pinefinancialgroup.com.
And for those of you listening, I'll put the links to the website, Justin's email address in the show notes as well, so you can find it. Justin, man, thank you so much. I learned a few things today and hope our listeners did as well. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.